office and show what you've been working on in your spare time.
Spare time, again.
Yeah, so you are known notoriously in the community for doing the Adobe Illustrator to XAML converter.
Correct.
You ran
one of two, by the way. Someone else has now built one.
Right. You ran the contest on more converters,
mm-hmm.
but while the contest was going on, you built another converter.
I did.
And what did you build?
I built a tool that basically takes a Flash, a Swift file, so all the animations you see on the web basically, takes a Swift file and moves it over into WPF.
Very cool.
Now, so, I say that, and it sounds like a grand claim, and we'll talk in some detail, I'm sure, about what it does and what it doesn't do. It's not quite that magic.
But let's look at it first.
You bet.
You know, let's cut to the chase here. What do we got here?
So I've got a file that I grabbed off the internet. As a matter of fact, it's a sample file that you can find via Electric Rain's site. That just happens to be an animation that was spit out of their Swift 3D product. So this was authored in their Swift 3D product. It was true 3D at one point, and then it got exported to a Flash file, so a Swift file. So I've basically done a file open, pointed to a Swift, and I've ended up with this animation. And if I hold down a key over here, I basically get all of the individual frames that are in that Swift file animating on screen.
Nice.
So it's important to note that there is no Flash player here. This literally is a Swift file opened into what we're seeing here rendered as WPF.
Cool.
So you can see there's quite a lot of detail there. As a matter of fact, I can expand this. I don't know what it's going to do to your camera image, but...
Yeah.
See, it looks...
That's great.
It's all scalable vectors,
mm-hmm.
as you'd expect, and we get the higher quality when we go large.
Can you show us around the tool a little bit?
You bet. So, basically, to open a file, it's as simple as you'd expect, file open, and I've got a bunch of, basically, files that I've opened out on the internet,
mm-hmm.
so some of these come from a lot of different places. Here's another animation that I can just click through frame by frame, or, of course, I can just hold the thing down and I basically get the animation.
Right.
Now I want to note what's really going on here. Although it looks like it's being animated in WPF, in fact what I'm doing is I'm converting each frame individually. So
okay.
It takes apart a frame in the Swift file and converts it into a WPF basically element tree and then displays it in this element host inside of this application. So I can click through frame by frame basically, and if I hold that down, of course it looks like it's animating.
But
it's not taking advantage of WPF native animation yet.
Right.
So,
okay.
Some other features of the tool, and I'll have a screencast that you can probably go check out to support most of this. You can save frames as bitmaps if you want. I can launch the XAML version of this, so if I click on Launch XAML, it actually spits out the XAML representation and then fires up your XAML browser, which
uh-huh.
in my case is Internet Explorer, so there's
uh-huh.
that individual frame rendered in Internet Explorer. I can also just copy the XAML, so I can go edit, copy XAML. It does pretty much the same thing. Let me fire up XAMLPad here. And I can just go down here and paste that XAML. And let me pull down our view so we can see what we're looking at here. And there I get the frame basically rendered in XAMLPad,
okay.
right?
Yep.
So pretty simple. There's a bunch of preferences you can set that the screencast probably will go in more depth on.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of things I can view. File information and display list happen to both be turned on, and you'll notice over here on the right, I've got some file information. It shows the version, it shows the frame rate, how many frames we're looking at.
Uh-huh.
But the more interesting piece is probably the display list down in the lower right here. And inside of, basically when you read a Swift file, it describes a bunch of shapes and definitions. Those could include fonts or characters like the character we see on the screen here. And then there's a bunch of commands that place those predefined shapes onto what they call the display list. And it's basically a bunch of layers that contains shapes that have been transformed and translated into different locations in the frame, right? So over here on the right, you see kind of my representation of that display list. And what it allows you to do is basically dig into a shape, find out a bunch of technical details, frankly, the matrix that was used to transform uh-huh. it to the screen. But more importantly, and what's useful for conversion, is the ability to kind of uncheck some of these features. So I can turn off elements of this frame, so I can remove some of those characters in the background, and kind of leave myself with maybe just the element that I want. And lo and behold, when I do copy XAML, fire up XAMLPad again, paste, and well, I don't know why my XAMLPad's doing that, but there I get just the character I was interested
in. Right, right.
So basically the display list feature over on the right allows you to kind of isolate just the elements that you want so I can play him off the screen, right?
Very
turn
nice.
Features the animation back on, and I can get the rest. So I can kind of go through this file and say, hey, you know, maybe I lost the original authoring file for the guy on the right. So I can basically just disable the features until I have the guy on the right, and you get the rest of the story.
Go.
So some other features here, I can advance sprites. And I don't have any sprites in this particular animation, but we saw it when that 3D walker that we started the video out with was actually what's called a sprite. If you're used to the Flash authoring environment, it's called a movie clip inside of the authoring tool. And the easiest way to think of it is another Flash animation inside of a Flash animation. So it's got its own set of frames and its own animation. And basically, this feature up here, View Advanced Sprites, just advances the sprites in your scene by one frame.
Right.
So earlier on, when we were showing that 3D walker, I was actually just advancing the sprite frames. They've got wireframe mode, which is interesting really just to see the strokes and how they convert. So, again, mostly for kind of diagnostic purposes or really to see what's going on inside the shapes. Let me turn that off. And then the other feature here is what I call onion skin mode. I don't know how useful this will be to anyone else, and frankly, it's kind of gratuitous. So let me just show you an example of what I've used it for. Let me open, let's just open a file here, let's just pick this one. So here's a simple, kind of an arm, and if it animates, it actually looks the muscles move, the ball gets thrown, and so on. So what I would do in kind of comparing the conversion quality is first view this at original size. So there's the original size of the animation. All right, now I'm going to fire up the original Swift file. So here's the original Swift playing in Macromedia's Flash Player, right?
Uh-huh.
So let me pause this animation. Let's see if I remember how to pause the animation. I can't seem to do it here, but you'll get the point when I show you how this works. So I basically can go into onion skin mode, and it allows me to layer my app on top of the other, and I can do a lot of visual kind of fidelity comparisons to see how close what I've converted to WPF is represented in the Swift file. So,
are you pretty happy with the losslessness? Or?
Pretty happy. There's certainly a lot of cases, and I'll probably enumerate them on the site where you can get the tool. I'll enumerate some areas that you have to watch out for. A lot of them are kind of edge cases, so in the common scenario, you won't see many of them. And the way to kind of go into maybe a little more background on...
Go back to looking at your face, and let's talk about kind of, why you built it, what it's useful for.
So, like you, I work with a lot of early adopters, and of course, I'm kind of known for that Illustrator exporter. I get email through my blog that says, hey, Mike, when are you going to support this, this format or this style? And the contest has generated a lot of good entries, but nobody yet has written one that does Flash files. Flash files are interesting because they're fairly complex. They have about a 10-year or so lineage, right? They're up to version 9 or something like that. There are a lot of features in a Flash file. And the way the Swift file is, the way it looks, if you were to kind of open it up and peer inside of it, it's basically composed of a bunch of tags, what they call tags. And they're all... very compact, kind of bit field level development. It reminds me of the days when I used to do data compression or encryption libraries. So very efficient about the use of bits. And there's these tags that have IDs, and basically the entire file is composed of these tags. So one tag that starts out the file is like the file information. What's my stage size? What's the width? What's the height? What's the frame rate I should play back? And so on. And then it starts to get into defining shapes and glyphs, fonts, for example. So there will be a tag called define shape, and there's actually four variants of that tag that basically say, here's what my geometry for this shape is, and store it in what you call a dictionary with a specific ID, what they call a character ID. So in the case of our little animated guy earlier, there would have been a define shape tag that says, here's kind of the lines and the colors and the fills that make up what this guy looks like, store him off in my dictionary as character ID, let's say 1, right? Then there may be another define shape that does the same thing for the other guy and stores it in the dictionary as character ID number 2, and so on. Eventually, you'll run into a tag called place object, and place object basically says, take the object that you've previously defined in your dictionary with a character ID of 2, so our walking guy, and splat him out on the stage basically using this transformation. So rotate him and scale him and do these sorts of things. So there'll be a bunch of place objects, and then you'll run into a tag called show frame, and that basically tells a Flash player that, hey, all the work you've done up until now to build up this display list, well, spit it out on the screen as pixels and display it. And then the process continues.
Right.
So there's really three things that can be converted from a Flash file into a WPF, into the WPF world. One is just the basic shapes and geometry, and that's really what the converter does now. It takes an individual frame and converts all of its geometry over into a WPF XAML representation. the second stage, which the tool doesn't do yet, or hopefully somebody else will write a tool that can do this as well, is basically taking the animation and what was intended when the author created the Swift file, kind of reverse engineer that animation and support it natively in WPF. So an example of that would be if I were to go into Expression Interactive Designer, for example, and say, take this thing that starts here in my frame and move it to here over the course of 10 seconds. Obviously, WPF is built to figure out where things need to be as they move.
Sure.
For Flash, in the Flash authoring tool, that is a similar experience. You say, take this circle that starts here and across 15 frames, because it's frame-based, not time-based. Across 15 frames, do what you need to do to figure it out. But when it spits it out in a Swift file, some of that motion information is lost. So where it was in the original .fla kind of project file that Flash uses, as soon as you publish it to a Swift file, it's basically a series of instructions like I just described to you that says that frame 1, it's here. Frame 2, it's here. Frame 3, it's there. Ideally, in WPF, you'd love it to just say, in frame 1, it's here. In frame 20, it's over here. And just use storyboarding and animation in WPF and let it do the right thing.
Right.
So the second level is really converting animation. And then the third level is kind of the pinnacle of conversion in my mind, is really to take the action script or the code that exists in a Swift file and convert the code to something like C# or VB, some managed code basically that can also be included in the file. So there's three levels. It's shape, animation, and code. And really this tool right now just does shapes. And for a lot of people that have emailed me, I think this is going to be helpful for them. So the big kind of challenge, if you want to kind of get geeky since this is a Channel 9 video, the challenge of converting from Swift shapes into WPF shapes is fairly significant. And I have to say that of all the things that it was was most difficult to do, it was probably that shape conversion. I can whiteboard if you want.
Yeah, please.
Cool.
How'd you do it?
How did
you do it?
Behind the scenes.
As
I mentioned, in the Swift file, there's kind of these tags. So imagine a Swift file. Let's say this is the stream of data from the beginning to the end of the file. Basically, it's broken up into these tags. One of these tags might be called define shape. And as I mentioned earlier, it really uses kind of some Swift instructions to describe what a shape looks like. And I'm going to simplify things a bit because it can get fairly technical.
Okay.
But just in the interest of time, I'll say that there's a bunch of records in this define shape tag, and they're called edge records. And then there are also what I'll call style change records. And there's a combination of these that make up this define shape tag. So what do I mean? So there's a line style. There is a fill 0 style and a fill 1 style. So what happens? I run into a define shape tag, and basically I start reading these records. The first record I'm going to run into is probably a style change record. And what it's kind of like saying, you've got these three brushes. I've got a line brush, I've got a fill brush, or a fill 0 brush, and a fill 1 brush. The style change basically tells me what colors to dip these brushes into. Right? So imagine these three brushes that I just always have as I'm drawing my shape. The first style change record may say, change your line style to black. Right? So let's say our line style is now black. So it's kind of like dipping that brush into black paint. It'll then say, change your fill 0 style to be, let's just say, red. And change your fill 1 to be blue. So now my brushes are kind of loaded up with paint and I'm ready for some more information. Then you'll run into a bunch of edge records. And edge records define the geometry of the shape. So they can be straight lines, they can be Bezier curved lines, and a combination of these. And I draw these edge records with whatever colors my brushes currently have. So let's take a shape that looks like this. And I'm going to let's jump into Technicolor here just so we can have a good discussion. So let's say that this shape on the left is filled with red, and the shape on the right is filled with blue. So in Flash, this is a perfectly legitimate shape. As a matter of fact, it can be defined as a single shape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting, if you've done much work with WPF, and I know you have, is that this really would be two shapes in WPF, right? It'd probably be a square over here on the left with a stroke on the outside of black and a fill inside of a solid color brush, which is red. And then I'd have one adjacent to it which with also a black stroke and then a fill of blue. Because in WPF, your path geometry
can only have one stroke style around the whole thing, right? And of course, a fill style, it could be lots of things, bitmaps and gradients and so on. So back to our story. I've set my styles. I'm now hitting edge records. So I'll hit an edge record that basically says, draw a line from this point to that point using the styles that I currently have. Now, I've messed up here because I've actually included some styles that don't apply to that line. So let's just talk about the figure. In this particular case, it'd say draw a line from here to here. My line style is pretty straightforward. It's just a black line style. My left, or my fill zero style, in this case, really should have been, I should have left this blank and made this red. We're channel line style here, so we'll adapt as we go. All right, so in this case, I've hit a style change that says I have black fill zero of nothing, basically a fill one of red. I'm drawing a straight line from this point to this point. Fill zero, in other words, my left side, is blank. There is no color there. But the fill on the right of me is red. All right, so then that makes sense. If I take this line from this point to this point, you'll notice it's the same thing. To the left of me is nothing. To the right of me is red. From this point, left of me nothing, red of me red, right? And then you can imagine a style change record that hits just before this line is drawn that basically dips the color instead of red. It changes it to blue. So now I can draw a line from here to here, left of nothing, right of blue, and so on, right? You get the story. The interesting thing about this file format is this middle line. So basically, I'm going to hit this middle line. Let's say it's from this point to this point. Fill right of blue is correct, so I would have had to hit a style change just before then that basically changed this to red. And now I've got an interesting scenario. I've got one line that's black from here to here. To the right of me is blue, to the left of me is red. There is no such construct in WPF like that, right? You know just as well as any of us. For rasterizing the data, the Flash Player, this is actually pretty useful information. But to convert it into true shapes and geometry in something like WPF, we need a little more structure. And if we go back to the rule we had earlier, where a WPF shape can only have one stroke style and a single fill style, what we ideally in this case would love to do is come up with the geometry we talked about earlier. I want a red filled square on the left, and right bumped up next to it, I want a blue filled square.
But you don't know you want that procedurally until you've hit it.
Exactly, right? Is that what was intended? Right.
Yeah,
So there's a little bit of magic, and like I said, this is the difficult part. So the way I accomplished it is basically said, well, I've got this set of lines with a bunch of fill styles. There's no such thing in WPF as a fill to the right of me or a fill to the left of me. So I had to come up with a way of basically rationalizing all this data into something that would eventually make sense in WPF. So what I did was this. I read the structure through, and I basically just arbitrarily decided one night when I was coding away that I'm only going to care about the fill style to my right, right? So this is an easy story. If I go back to this shape, from here to here, I've only got a red fill style to my right, and there's no left fill style, so I just throw that in a collection, basically. And I do that for most of these. This is the only one that has a fill style on both sides. So what I do is I store a line segment from here to here with a fill style to the right of blue and a fill style to the left of nothing, which of course is incorrect in this figure.
Mm-hmm.
But I throw that in my collection, and then what I do is I flip the line. So I store another line in my collection that never existed in the Swift file from here to here with a right fill style of red and a left fill style of nothing. So what I've done is I've taken this single segment in the Swift file and converted it into two segments for my own use. So at the end of the day, this algorithm goes, you know, on complex geometry can run a little bit of time. But at the end of the day, I only have lines with the right fill style and no left fill style. So now if you just kind of think through the experiment with me, I should be able to connect those lines, right? In other words, figure out which lines connect to what. Uh-huh. And another interesting thing about the Swift file format is I'm not guaranteed these are going to appear to me in a nice, useful fashion. In order to save space, they can kind of be in a random fashion. So I've got these collection of lines, and I look for start points that match end points and so on. So there's an algorithm that connects them up. And hopefully at the end of the day, once I've done that, I've got a bunch of lines that are connected to each other that share the same line style, which is what we need, and share the same fill style.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can actually turn that into a WPF path and spit it out of the screen. And you'll notice when you play with, if you download and you play with a converter, this works in a lot of cases. Now, to be fair, there's a couple edge cases that I haven't solved yet, and you'll see some visual glitching occasionally. But for the most part, this is how it works.
Wow.
Now, fortunately, the work that went into this is reused over and over again in the conversion.
Mm-hmm.
So in a Swift file, when you see a font on a screen, it actually isn't in It isn't a reference to a font on your system. What the Flash authoring tool does is if you type the word mic, basically what it does is it takes the glyph shape of the M and stores it as a shape as I've just defined. The I stores it as a shape. The K is a shape. The E is a shape. It doesn't store the rest of the alphabet, just the ones you use. So fortunately, after I did this work, of course, I could just reuse the work to convert the fonts over. And then there's some font layout issues and things like that. But depending on how complex the geometry is, this can take a little bit of time to run. So you'll see when you're playing an animation back, occasionally you might feel a little burp, and that's because it's actually doing quite a bit of work behind the scenes just to make sense of what it's trying to display.
Right. Can you you lost me on the font part there. Can you explain, how do you handle font? What does your tool do when it comes across what it... Does it discover that it's a font? Does it figure out that it's a font?
Well, the tag in the file, so I mentioned all these tags. There's a couple tags specifically related to fonts and text. One of the tags is called define font. And define font's purpose in life is to basically tell you what different glyphs in a character set look like, really. In other words... you don't need any knowledge on your local machine as to what a particular letter looks like because the Swift file contains that geometry.
Right.
So you can think of it kind of like an embedded font, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a set of shapes. So a defined font will say, define M as looking like this, right? In this whole conversion I just went through. Define I as looking like this. Again, the conversion, K and E. It won't define the rest of the alphabet, just the things, it's pretty greedy. Only the things that it needs is what it defines.
Right.
And once it's defined those in that dictionary I told you about, of course, they're now available for reference by other tags, and there happens to be a tag that comes later called define text. And define text then references a particular font, so it'll say, using the font, the set of glyphs that you previously saw as ID number whatever, select that thing, and then give me an M, an I, a K, and an E. So what ends up happening, and when you look at the exported XAML, is you'll actually see it'll look just like any other shape. There'll be no knowledge that it's a font.
I see.
It'll just look like
shapes.
Kind of like in my Illustrator exporter, you'd have to convert fonts to outlines and then spit them out. You couldn't really tell, short of maybe a comment I spit in the XAML, you couldn't really tell that it was text.
I see.
Yeah. Now, the Swift file format does have some other tags that are called, I think it's like dynamic text, which will reference a font on your machine. So, like, you've seen Flash apps that allow you to type in your name or something. It can use these glyphs that have been previously defined, or frankly, it can use a font on your system. So it may say, select font Arial, but it never has given you the glyphs. And of course, the Flash player will try to find your font on your system and then render it appropriately.
Right.
And right now, my converter doesn't do anything with those, but that, you can imagine, would be relatively trivial.
Right.
Yeah.
Depends on who you are.
I suppose it does, right?
Yeah. So relatively is the key word there.
Steeped in these bits and bytes.
I can't imagine. I mean, so what? You must just have, because you're down there reading some pretty gnarly.
As a matter of fact,
gnarly stuff.
I've experimented with this for a while, months. I haven't invested time over months, but it's been a little bit here, mm-hmm. a little bit there, and I've blogged a couple things like the shape conversion. I've got a blog entry on how that works, kind of. Probably not as good as this. And there was also, I did a post about reading the bits and bytes out of the Swift file and what a little bit of a challenge it was. And when I said it was a challenge, it's a challenge today because we're so used to working with XML and we've got classes that allow us to kind of crack open the XML. Not so intuitive to read these bits and bytes. For example, a matrix definition inside of a Swift file. So a matrix typically would have... four elements plus translation of X and Y, right? Mm-hmm. So you get some rotation, you can get skewing in there. What the Flash file format does is it will actually have one bit in the stream that will say whether or not it has rotation information or not. So if there's no rotation information beyond default, it'll actually say false, and there is no rotation information, right? If there's translation, so in other words, move it X coordinates and Y coordinates, it will actually tell you how many bits wide the number is to represent the translation. So there's actually a 5-bit field that tells you how wide to expect these fields that tell it how far to translate. So at 5 bits is what, a possibility of 32, right? So a 32-bit value, right? And then all of a sudden you'll read the translate X to the number of bits it just specified, and that's your translate X, and the same thing for Y. And this goes on and on and on.
Oh, man.
So, frankly, the initial challenge was just, how do you read this stuff? I got enough requests via my blog that I actually released a class that basically you can just stick in your own project and read these things. And then, you know, once you've figured that out, then it's actually kind of nice to have this class doing the work for you. And then to make matters a little bit more complicated, starting with Swift, I think version 6 and later, maybe earlier, the file after the header information can actually all of a sudden become compressed. So even though it already is kind of compressed, at least using these bit fields, you can read after the header, and if the header is like CWS, that basically means that you need to flip into a deflate algorithm, which is what Zip uses, and start deflating the stream as you go as well. So, it's tricky.
I can only imagine. All right. Well, thanks for the introduction.
No problem, no
problem.
Good
stuff. Any other things you want to close with?
Like I said, it works. The converter in its first release here works fairly well. You'll find that you open... there's an interesting story here, actually, that might be interesting. So I'm sitting here with all these... you can read the internet, you can read a bunch of references about all these flash tags and what they do. And I don't... If you counted them, there's fewer than 100, but it's somewhere like something like that. And I'm thinking to myself, what tags do I need to support in the common cases? So actually, one of the early things I wrote after I was able to understand the file format is I wrote a little crawler, for lack of a better word. And I basically just pointed it to some Swifts that I knew of and just let it crawl the net and find Swift files, grab the Swift files, and then count the tags and see which tags were used most. So kind of a statistical method of figuring out, of all the Swift files on the planet, what are the most common tags? As a matter of fact, you'll see some the results of some of that work actually exist in the tool. There's a feature called View Tag Statistics or something like that, and it'll tell you within that file the statistics of the tags. And once you have that, it was pretty obvious. Like, there's a million place object tags placing things in the frame and making things happen. So again, you'll see some of that. The other thing I'd want to point out is there is another tool, or you'll notice if you download the tool and install it, there's a Swift as AML EXE, which is the app we just demonstrated. And then there's actually a command line tool called Swift Tools. And I used it for debugging purposes. And if you just run Swift Tools against a Swift file, it'll spit out a bunch of kind of debug-ish information.
Oh, okay.
Kind of geeky. I don't know how useful it is. But if you kind of want to know what's inside that file and what it looks like, you can run that tool and it spits out a bunch of command line details.
Well, you're so to a certain extent, you're kind of, you want someone else to pick up.
I kind of do.
Where you
I left love
off.
It.
So you're trying to enable
exactly.
the next.
Exactly.
So
and
that's
the class
what we're doing
that, the class that reads the file actually, like I said, is downloadable from my blog already.
Right.
So the first hurdle is there. The how to convert shapes, which is the next big one, I've blogged about, and you heard me just talk about it here.
Right.
Now, animation and how to kind of reverse engineer some of that animation and then actually action script to something like C Sharp, that's beyond me at the moment. And frankly, this is a spare time deal, and although my wife might disagree that it's a spare time deal, it is a spare time thing, and I'd love to see others kind of pick up the work and do better. Frankly.
Yeah.
But for now,
Great.
Solve some of the cases.
Very good.
Cool.
Well, thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Karsten.